is near the antenna feed point. And so with an inverted V, you have the highest elevation at the portion of the antenna that's radiating most of the RF. In the case of an actual V, it'll end up being the lowest portion. So there's no real benefit of the legs being elevated that much because most of the energy is going out nearer to the center fed area than to either edge of the legs. The edge of the legs are low current, high voltage points. So, you know, elevating those really doesn't give you much benefit. Elevating the middle gives you a significant improved performance for center fed dipoles.
Good. You just talked me out of trying to put up another wire in the other tree. I don't want to push my luck, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, if the height wouldn't gain me anything, which I see now it wouldn't, there's no reason to do that and to presume it would work any better than an NFED half wave, because I know on an NFED half wave, the height does matter. The height does matter. So mine is up about 40 feet in the tree right now, and I guess I'll just leave it like that.
KGQR1.
Yes, David?
Hello, everybody. I hope you're all having a fantastic evening. About antennas, well, my antenna is made of wire. It's sort of like a sloper. Sloper, one side is higher than the other. And the middle is where the feed point is. A very simple construction. It seems to work okay, although, you know, I'm doing the best that I can for the amount of space that I have.
Well, yeah, that's understandable. I mean, we're all kind of operating compromise antennas. Now, Rich mentioned something about NFEDs versus half-wave center fed. The efficiency of a half-wave center fed, even, you know, I mean, elevation will have an effect, but you also have to factor in the unfortunate reality that NFEDs all require, 49 or 64 to 1 unons. They tend not to be very efficient, and so you're going to lose a significant amount of efficiency just going through the unun, where you wouldn't need anything like that for a center fed, no matter what its elevation would be. So, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other, they're not equivalent, but, you know, in some situations, a V-configured center fed might be more efficient than an NFED.
I had to please the building management, set it up basically as best as I could.
Yeah, well, you always have to be on the good graces of supers and such. I know guys who regularly give them a bottle of scotch every Christmas just to grease the the ways for them to maintain their antennas.
QSL, well, you know about this antenna, the Alpha Delta, Delta X-ray, Echo Echo, Space Saver, 10 through 40 meter fan dipole.
Yeah, I've had a few of the slightly larger ones that go from 10 meters to 80 meters with loading coils.
Well, from 20 to 40 on this antenna, also loading coil.
Yeah, it's a slightly smaller version of the 10 to 80 version.
QSL. Well, I'll tell you, I've had a lot of fulfillment with it. I got a lot done, and I was able to make a lot of really great contacts. And in its simplicity. And, of course, you know, Super had to help me with it, and it had to be according to specification, and so the building would be happy.
Okay, all's well that goes well. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Alpha Delta's fan dipoles. You do have to put in a little thought to the installation, and usually you have to kind of tune them. We talked about it recent week. I prefer that if you're going to shorten the wires rather than come off and keep them short, I would suggest bending them over and wrapping around so they're functionally shortened. But if at some point in the future, for some reason, you need to retune them and they need to be longer, it's easier to lengthen a wrapped around element than to lengthen a cut element. But I like Alpha Delta. They're a good company, and you know, some people certainly like to wind their cut their own, and that saves you a bunch of money. They have very good hardware for the center tap, and they have lightning protection built into that mount to the plastic. And so I think Alpha Delta is a good company. I have bought a few of their fan dipole antennas. Yeah, you're about 50-60% noise, so if somehow you can kind of boost the signal, move the antenna a little bit around, increase the gain, whatever, try.
I don't know, is this any better? How about a trap dipole? Do you like trap dipoles?
A lot of people like a lot of trap dipoles. I tend not to because there's a easy way for them to malfunction. They require more maintenance than a fan dipole. Fan dipoles have no particular weak spot. You know, they're all wired together, whereas the traps are installed and there's always a point of corrosion, or insects get into the trap, or birds get into the trap. So it requires more maintenance. A lot of people love traps and they buy high-quality traps, or they don't mind doing the proper maintenance for traps. But there's a little bit more maintenance to be done for a trap antennas and simple fan dipoles.
I want to get out of here because I'm noisy, but I agree with you. Fan dipoles have been around forever and they do work very well.
You know about Kellerman trap dipoles?
Who are you asking that question, Dave?
To the gentleman who is speaking.
No, I don't. I played with trap dipoles about
46 years ago. Kellerman trap dipoles, made in Germany, very good quality. The traps are sealed, but I don't know, they look pretty good. I've never used one.
Yeah, I would imagine they're rather expensive.
QSL could be. They have all different sizes and configurations. You know, it looks pretty good from the picture.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure, you know, German craftsmanship, you know, they usually build everything like a tank. But they charge you the price of a tank, too.
USL. Well, what I wanted to say is that the resonant bandwidth of frequencies that my antenna will allow me to tune. The radio has a tuner in it, and then there's an external tuner on top of the radio. One or the other, not both, one or the other, give me better performance on certain band frequencies.
That's not unusual. I mean, there are different ways to wire antenna tuners. There are impedance transforming circuits. There are T circuits, L circuits, pi circuits, and a bunch of others. They all have different ranges depending upon the value of their inductors and capacitors. And so, you know, one antenna tuner might not be able to tune to 50 ohms nominal impedance, while another one that uses different inductor capacitor or different tuning circuits might be able to. We've talked before that sometimes just adding a 3-foot jumper to some wires will rotate the impedances on the transmission line into an area that the same exact antenna tuner can now tune. So I had an antenna tuner that I needed to put that 3-foot jumper on if I wanted to tune on 10 meters. If I took it off, I couldn't tune because it just failed to rotate the impedance into its match area.
QSL. Well, the tuner in the radio can very successfully tune 10, 15, 20, and 40. And the external tuner, the AT100 Pro 2 auto tuner made by LZG, that tunes on 17 and 12 very successfully. Even though the antennas, you know, they do not specify whether they will tune on 17 and 12. And, yeah, it works pretty good. I can't complain there.
Okay, good to hear. Yes, Howie?
Yeah, some of the best tuners that I ever had, a Murch and a Johnson tuner. Give me an old-fashioned Pi or a T-network, you can switch it. But an old-fashioned tuner with roller inductors, you can't beat them. Yeah, they require you to do the work, but they definitely work.
Yeah, yeah, Pis are very difficult. I don't think any manufacturer these days manufactures Pi networks. The roller inductors are alive and well and living among other places, my Pal Star antenna tuner.
But a really good tuner is going to cost you money because you want silver contact. You need a nice, heavy induction, good connection. I'll tell you what. I don't know if you can find them, but the military made some really nice automatic antenna tuners, but those probably cost you a couple thousand dollars today if you can find them on the surplus market. I remember Collins made an antenna tuner, but back then they wanted over $1,000 in the 60s.
Yeah, well, in some ways the prices have gone down, and others the quality has gone down. My Pal Star, it's a rolling inductor. It's silver coated, so it meets your criteria. It's all none of their tuning systems have relays. The very small, relatively less expensive things like LDG and others use a bunch of discrete components and relays to kind of put them in and out of circuit. And, yeah, I like my Pal Star a lot. I've often said, you know, you can tune a doorknob with my Pal Star.
Yeah, you've got to make sure that all your contacts are deoxidized and your cables are good and your ports and your connectors go in also deoxidized.
Yeah, that's always a good practice.
Question, is the Pal Star use vacuum type capacitors? What kind of capacitors do they use?
No, it's a regular air gap capacitor.
Well, I'll tell you, I had a Johnson that had vacuum capacitors. That thing, someone gave it to me. That thing must have cost several hundred dollars back then. That thing you could tune up a bed spring. I actually tried that on 40, trying to tune up the bed. And I'm laughing. I was like 13 years old. I did it with a novice radio. That thing actually did work. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of power carrying capacity. By putting it in a vacuum instead of air, you increase the rated breakdown voltage so that you can have a much more powerful, completely illegal transmitter be tuned. An air capacitor works fine for, you know, I am capable of about 1.3 kilowatts. I usually operate it below 500 watts. The place where I see a lot more use for vacuum capacitors these days, Rich W2BZ mentioned magnetic loops. Magnetic loops will benefit from having air vacuum capacitors. It allows you to operate the magnetic loop at a much higher watts than air gaps do.
Yeah, one comment about magnetic loop safety. I don't think people understand it. You start running any kind of power, the magnetic field, the voltage here will be pretty high. So, you know, I know people put them in their apartments. The best thing is to have it in the room that you're not in and run a cable to it. So, got to be careful with magnetic loop. The shorter, the smaller the antenna, the higher the voltage is because the Q goes crazy.
Yeah, that's always a good caution. Most people, though, who set up magnetic loops in their house usually aren't going to spend any money for vacuum capacitors, and the usual MFJ versions that they buy are, you know, will only tolerate about 20 watts or so. And, you know, I don't know how dangerous a 20 watt, but always you got to be cautious because of the high Q of these types of antennas.
QSL, you know, I have a couple of mobile whips, one pair for 20, one pair for 40. Was able to make contacts, but put them, connect them, assemble them into fan stick dipole, 38 inches each side, and with 15 watts I made contacts, you know, simple as that, you know. And magnetic group, okay, but you know, two mobile antennas can be very inexpensive and they do work. You just have to stay within a certain bandwidth for frequency range.
Well, you know, these mobile antennas are basically bottom-loaded whips, so you have a significant loss of efficiency. I mean, sometimes you can communicate with the people you want to with a 5 or a 10% efficient antenna. So, you know, it's not a definite, absolute contraindication. But everyone should understand that you pay a certain price for using those mobile antennas. Because they use shortened elements and they make it up electronically with a inductive load, you have to pay the price with a high Q, as you mentioned. It narrows your effective resonant ranges, and it also interacts and produces insertion losses and such. So the efficiencies, you know, the companies that sold mobile antennas sold them all the way up to 180 meters. And the reality is that 160 meters. And the, you know, at 160 meters for a significantly shortened whip, you know, the efficiency for something like that maybe on a good day is about 3%. So the thing is that sometimes 3% is all that you need, but sometimes it isn't. So, you know, keep that in mind.
Couple of comments here. Roy, having I play around with 10 meters, and I got a couple of 10-meter HT portables, a 10-meter HT portable. It's got, like, you know, a 12-inch coil antenna. At the end of it, if you put your face near it, you get an RF burn. So be careful of the Q. And when you say the mobile antenna is only 3% efficient, not according to Dick. If you can resonate it, you'll be about 95% of a full-size dipole. So if you're using high-quality components, and most of those components have very low DC resistance, you should be get close to 95% in a resonant antenna.
I disagree. If that was the case, why would we put up mechanically resonant antennas? We just put up a couple of ham sticks and call it a day. I remember Dick, may rest in peace, used to discuss the infinitesimal dipole. And, my response tended to be, if you happen to live next door to the JPL lab and can borrow all their equipment and the materials, and you could make things out of really sophisticated material, maybe. The insertion losses for minuscule antennas that are made resonant with discrete components is significant. So if you have any insertion loss, the radiation resistance for some of these severe infinitesimal antennas is a hundredth of an ohm. So you have insertion loss of an ohm or two, and you know you're all going up that insertion loss. So although on a theoretical basis, yeah, but you know life isn't theoretical. Life is practical, and we don't have access to JPL labs all the time.
Well, you know, there was a man who drove his 4x4 along the beach somewhere in Saudi Arabia, and the clearance was so good that he was able to make amazing DX contacts from his car. And the idea is, you know, people can do that. They could set up station, you know, and with the specification of the antenna and the car, etc., you know, they can make a lot of great DX, you know, from some urban center.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. Yes, Howie?
I'm sorry to step on you. Don't leave a pause. What I was going to say, if you had loss, you would see in heat, and if you really want to prove it, like Dick always said, take a camera, an infrared camera, and see if you see heat. That's number one. And number two, the reason why they use full-size antennas is because of the bandwidth. That's one of the reasons, and you'll get less nulls, okay? When you go to a short antenna, it's going to have a slightly different pattern, but not much. But I can tell you from practice, when I was on CB and played around with 10 meters, if I took a 3-foot mobile whip and put it in the center of the car, 9-foot whip, they were very close, maybe an eighth of a dB. You couldn't tell the difference. But a good 3-4 foot base-loaded whip in the center of a car on mobile did very, very well. So, but the bandwidth would tighten it up. So if you took a 9-foot quarter wave, you might get 700-800 kilohertz with no problem. But if you took a base-loaded 3-foot whip, you got 300 kilohertz, which was fine because that was the bandwidth for CB was only about 250 when they were in the 23 channel days. But you can make those measurements, and you can go out in the field and make those measurements, Roy. I beg to differ with you. From engineering and knowing how antenna theory works, a base-loaded antenna is only going to be about 2 or 3% less efficient than a full-size resonant antenna.
I take a Yaesu FT60 Romeo HT. And make sure, you know, how can I prevent the radio from getting hot when I'm making QSO? And what I did was I cleaned out the corrosion in there. I put a new antenna on it, and now it doesn't get warm at all. I think it had something to do with the connection between the radio and the antenna causing some high SWR.
I don't think it's high SWR. I think it's insertion loss. And, you know, regular resistance generates heat. It might generate a lot of heat. It might diffusely generate heat over a large area. So unless you have some sophisticated test equipment, you're not going to really see, if the entire surface of your transmission line and antenna go up a couple of degrees Fahrenheit, you're not going to really be able to register that without scientific equipment. But it's insertion loss. Insertion loss is a very important aspect of efficiency of an antenna and transmission line system. And the lower your radiation resistance is, the more troublesome the insertion loss is, because it's, you know, what percentage is the radiation resistance and what percentage is the regular inefficiency and insertion loss resistance. So it was probably just the insertion loss in ohms that was using up a lot of your RF energy and in turning it into waste heat instead of radio waves.
AC2PL?
Excuse me. What kind of radio
is much better now. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear that. Howie, what do you want to say?
Yeah, I was going to ask two questions. One, what radio was he using? He said something about an ST60 handheld. Was that a low-band radio? Because sometimes it's most likely going to be the impedance. If you want to find out if it's heat or loss, measure the current. If the current goes up, when you put on a bad antenna, measure the current on transmit somehow, and you'll see if the radio is matching up. But, Roy, I beg to differ with you. If the quality of materials, if you make the coil out of good quality, look, you got an ATAS driver antenna. Both of the antennas work very well. The only thing is you get very tight bandwidth. And by the way, the smaller you make the antenna, the smaller the impedance. When you shorten the antenna, the lower the resistance. So you have to match that, basically. You have to match that to 50 ohms. So that could be sometimes of an issue, too. So that's why people like to use, almost full-size antennas, because the half wave is going to be, close to 75. You can make it 50 ohms if you make it into an inverted V. And if you want to go to 300 ohms, you make a full wave loop.
AC2PL.
Yes, Jeff.
I'd like to know what evidence Howie has for his 95% efficiency compared to a full wave antenna.
Yeah, I tend to think that there's no such thing as a 95% efficient antenna. If you look it up in Google, not that Google's that brilliant, they quote as the most efficient antenna listed in their records is something like 80%.
Yeah, what measurements have been done on his CB whips in the middle of his car? Go ahead, Howie.
Well, I didn't mention the efficiency. Where does 95% come from? It comes from the chat, but is it? I forgot the name of that book. That very famous antenna book. That very famous antenna book, and plus taking a couple of courses at the same college that Dick did in magnetic theory and fields and waves. You can do those calculations. You do those calculations and you come up with 95%. And if you do it for a loaded antenna, it's about 90%. So there are calculations. You can do fields and waves. And then just the reading. I didn't do those exact calculations, but Dick did them, and a whole bunch of other people used millions of dollars of equipment at test ranges. So, that's what Dick did. That's what Dick did for a living, and he also designed antennas. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, if you Google it, you can't find it anywhere, so I'm not quite sure where all the secret knowledge is. And when I talked to Dick, it was more on a theoretical basis, and I accept and understand theoretical basis. There's a lot of interesting things theoretically that don't really happen in real life because we don't live in a theoretical perfect universe. Because otherwise, the impedance of a half-wave NFED would be infinite ohms. That's what the equations say, because we can't really have it be theoretically strict. It's not quite a half wave, so it's about 3,000 ohms. So there's a big difference between talking theory and equations and actual circuits that in the real world we can build in our backyard.
You know, with the high Q antenna, if you're within the range of bandwidth, resonance, you should be able to get pretty decent performance.
Well, you can certainly get resonance because you're in the resonant range, but again, I would suggest you look at any book you want to look. Magnetic loops problems tend to be their lack of efficiency. They don't put anything like 80% of your transmitter power into the RF because Their radiation resistance is a fraction of an ohm. And just the general, in reality, insertion loss of any kind of antisystem has to introduce something like a couple of ohms. And so a lot of the radiation, a lot of the current goes as heat instead of RF. So, again, I am not aware of any mystical books that, you know, talk about 90% efficient antennas or that magnetic loops are efficient. Magnetic loops are infamous for inefficient, but they're practical and useful in the real world, and so we all use them.
Right. You're missing the point on magnetic loops. I agree with you. Magnetic loops are not going to be 90%. They're going to be a lot less. They don't use the regular B and H fields. They're magnetic. They're not. They don't propagate the same way. They're more like a ferrite bead. Okay. And they're really designed for lower frequencies, like 80, 40, and 20. You're really not going to want to use them on the higher frequencies. But a loaded antenna, like a loaded 3-4 foot whip that you would use on 8, 20, or 15, or 10, that's not a magnetic loop. That's due a traditional traveling, you know, regular type of antenna structure.
Okay, but there are different antennas. But a lot of people are describing magnetic loops these days more as shortened dipole, special case dipoles. So, I mean, you know, that's another thing we could discuss for a few hours. But they all have lower radiation resistance, which tends to be a big important factor in the efficiency of any radiating antenna.
Well, Dick talked about this. He said a very short antenna will work on almost any frequency that you could tune it. And you put the tuner up by the antenna and you use some kind of remote tuning from the shack.
Yeah, he mentioned the infinitesimal dipole, and he mentioned that the radiation aperture is almost equivalent. It's off by about a half of a decibel of a full-size antenna, and that's all absolutely positively true. But like I said before, the problem where that bites you on the backside is that as you shorten an antenna, even if you electrically correct for its resonance, you decrease its radiation resistance. And so the external non-radiation resistance, the caloric radiation, the insertion loss has a greater and greater effect on the efficiency of the antenna system, as opposed to if you have a full-size one where, in most cases, the radiation resistance is 50 ohms. In the case of magnetic loops, you know, we're talking about a tenth of an ohm or a hundredth of an ohm. That happens as you shorten antennas generally. The radiation resistance goes down, down, down. And the effect that other resistances that are thermal, caloric, have a more profound effect on the efficiency. You can use better equipment and diminish the insertion loss to a degree depending upon your wallet. Most people have a limited amount of money that they can spend. They can't get real high-quality stuff that has, you know, a hundredth of an ohm of insertion loss. And so they have to pay the price with efficiency. And because there's no easy way to measure efficiency, a lot of people, you know, don't have to consider it that much. So, you know, they use whatever thing works for them.
KG2RY. USL. There was a man in Finland, a ham radio operator. He had two antennas, one for 20, one for 10. And what each was some kind of very simple wire antenna. Try to think what it was called, you know. Basically a rectangle, and the feed point was the middle of the bottom, and then the wires went to either side, and then went up, and then they met at the top. And he told me that they're very good for noise, and they tune very well. The resonance is quite good for them. I don't know anything about insertion loss, though. Do you know about these antennas?
Yeah, I mean, they do take up a bit of room. It's not really a great thing in Brooklyn as far, you know, I have a 50 by 20 foot lot. But yeah, they have people hold them in very high regard, and people use them all the time.
Yeah, one comment: they're not 50 ohm antennas. Those are like DC loops. Those are like delta loops or a big circle. And usually the formula is 1,000 divided by the frequency. They're basically a full-wave loop. But remember, Roy, they need about 300 ohms. And you want to use them. You know what? Another thing. If you have SWR, you probably have to put. You got two choices. Put the antenna tuner at the antenna, right at the antenna, or use twin lead, you know, open ladder line, because open ladder line has the lowest loss.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. There were people who used to be on our lovely little tech net who ran a non-resident center-fed, two-level that weren't resident, and they tuned them with the antenna feeder. Either they use the open line, which you mentioned, which used to be very, very, very common back in the good old days, or else they simply put the antenna tuner remotely at the point of the center feed and tuned it and sent it down the regular coax cable. It's a very effective way of getting a good antenna.
I don't remember if he was using ladder line or coax, but the antenna, it was like 23 feet high and like 13 or 14 feet wide. And the 10-meter version of this antenna was smaller. It was smaller, appropriately smaller.
Yeah, well, that's the nature of antennas. They tend to scale. So if you have a big antenna for a low frequency, you'll need a version that's smaller for a higher frequency.
QSO. Yeah, it was quite impressive. He sent me pictures of it, said this is how you build it, you know, and one was for 20, one was for 10. I guess for me it would be difficult. I like all the other bands, too.
Yeah, those are monoband design. They're really not designed for multiple bands.
Yeah, but well, you know, somebody in Alpha Delta with my headset at halfway.
10 through 40, including 17 and 12.
Yeah, unfortunately, they tripled. Not... Yes, Howard?
I'm sorry, I don't need to keep interrupting, but you can take a loop antenna, you know, like a full-size loop, you know, like an 80-meter loop or a 40-meter loop and tune it on any frequency. If you put the tuner right up at the loop, they will work pretty well. The only thing is to have a weird pattern, but you can't use loops. That's the only thing. And one good thing about loops is a quiet antenna, because remember, they're DC grounded. They get rid of static electricity, because sometimes you get noise because of the wind hitting your antenna or local, you know, local low frequency noise. But a loop antenna, that's the reason why they're good for low noise.
Yeah, it's a good, but again, it's not really for very, very tight suits. I think most people would prefer to have them built to resonant frequencies rather than have them, impedance matched with a tuner, at least for their primary frequency. I don't know exactly how well or badly, you could tune a doorknob, but that doesn't, it means that you're matching the impedance, but you're not particularly making an efficient radiator out of a doorknob.
Well, what if you took a 40-meter loop, a 20-meter loop, 15-meter loop, and a 10-meter loop, and put them together, you know, like, like a fan dipole, you would have like a fan-connected loop, and you could use one feed point and one cable.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I think theoretically, the equations, it would work. It would take up a real enormous volume And I don't know if anyone would actually care to have that much space being taken up with that type of technology, but I see no particular reason why it shouldn't work.
What if you hang a suit in a closet, you know, hang it from the top and somehow secure it at the bottom and just leave it there?
Okay, Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Howie?
I know. I'm going to make this comment. If you could keep saying about, oh, we have to match the antenna, it gets harder. If that was true, let's take for an example. Take a tube transmitter, a classic 200-watt, 300-watt CW transmitter, I don't know, running a pair of 6146s. The impedance at the output of that plate is about 5,000 ohms. So you have a pi network, you go from 5,000 down to 50. Okay, if you make the pi network pretty well, those things have pretty good efficiency. You don't lose more than a fraction of a dB if you take a dummy loon. So you can match anything. What I think you guys are saying, and I always said this too, they don't work as well sometimes. The problem with antennas that are not resonant is the pattern is different. They may get out, but remember, you know, if you're using a loop or using, you know, something like a dipole that's not a half wave, the pattern is going to be totally different. That is the only thing I disagree with Dick, is that, but if it's a vertical, you can do it. But a loop antenna that's not resonant is going to have a weird pattern. That's the problem. Like, if you take an 80-meter antenna and tune it up on 10, it's going to have a lot of gain at some points. It's going to have a lot of nulls. Back to you. But, you know, just understand, if I can match the output of a tube to a 50-ohm transmission line efficiently, then I should be able to do that anyway. That blows away your argument.
Well, my friend Gene is a big fan of a half-wave antennas that are center-fed, you know, and he swears by them.
Ah, welcome, Ed. What do you have to tell us?
I'm trying to understand what Howie's, I knew it was Howie's message is. Because, yeah, a pair of 6146s will have about 5,000 ohms of peak. The runs will pine out what was 7,000 to nominally 50. Yeah, that's fine. The problem is, they don't make them anymore. Transistors now have a fixed output impedance designed for 50 ohms, and you get an antenna that matches it, or you get some kind of matching network that matches it. And I'm not sure what the problem is with that. But the second issue is about if you operate an antenna at a different frequency, assuming you're using an antenna tuner, it will have a different pattern. Very, very true. I'll also add, and I've said this on this frequency many, many times, most ham antennas, certainly around here, are next to the house, surrounded by trees, and if you don't think that changes your antenna pattern, you're wrong. And the rule is, as a general rule, if you're using a non-directional antenna, or a directional antenna, unless you have a carefully manufactured antenna, let me go back. The official designation is you're assuming it's a totally open space, or over an infinite conducting ground plane. And if you don't meet those criteria, your pattern of radio goes to hell. And any further changes goes from hell one to hell two. The idea is if you hear anybody and they hear you, don't sweat the details.
Yeah, I mean, the point is because the efficiencies of antennas, maybe the Army can, with their anechoic chambers and their RF meters and their integrators, It basically is a, does it work for you? If it works for you, then everything is fine. And I agree also with Howie that, that changing from a non-resonant frequency on an antenna, even if you match the impedance, will distort the radiation pattern and produce all kinds of interesting nulls and high points, hot spots. Because, again, all these things are much more complicated in reality than they are when you assume a theoretical system. And I agree with you, Ed, that, you know, you're never going to meet those theoretical criteria because they're theoretical. They're not realistic. And in order to bring reality that close to theory, no one has that amount of money, including JPL.
Do you know how many hours I spent on antenna ranges?
I assume a great deal of time.
What? Absolutely.
What about if it's raining?
What about it?
Did you change the performance of the antenna?
Yeah, as I told this, the things that change the performance. But it's not significant.
What if it's in the middle of your car on the top?
Well, it's an approximation of an interesting phenomenon. So to have a proper vertical antenna, like most mobile antennas do, that's the optimum.
Yeah, it's not a good ground plane. It's a terrible approximation of a perfect ground plane.
That's right. And a total approximation of a real
antenna pattern. AG2RY. Yeah, you know, some people, you know, like me, have a very, I can't think of the word, you know, very simple equipment, very simple radio, low power, etc. Antennas, very simple. It's sort of like having a mobile station in the middle of the city.
WDKWW, Roy, I give you a great example of an antenna. Well, you have a lot of gain and a lot of null. Take traveling wave antennas or a beverage antenna, which they used back in the 1920, when W1AW did, they tried to do test communications with England to see if they could do that on 200 kilohertz. They ran 5-10 mile antennas, real long antennas, many wavelengths. At the other end, they had a 600 ohm resistor. So, you know, look at a beverage antenna. You know, yeah, you can match anything, but the patterns are going to be crazy. That's the only thing. And as far as matching antennas, I'll say again, look at what happens. And by the way, one of the problems you have with matching antennas to the new solid state radios, they're mainly broadband. They only are about a couple. They're about a half an ohm. Another thing, Roy, if you look at a, let's say, 100-watt radio, what is the impedance of a 100-watt radio? It's not 50 ohms. I mean, it's got to be matched up. They're using T-networks. They don't use PIs because they got to go up in impedance. It's about a tenth of an ohm. You take 100 watts, figure out what the current is, you know, 12 volts. You need some tremendous current there to get 100 watts output. So your resistance is going to be around a quarter of an ohm. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, Ed, please.
All solid state are designed to have 50 ohms output speed, and then it's your problem from there. They manufacture them such that it's always around 50 ohms, and it is linked to the band switch. If you change bands, the built-in filters change. So they're designed to maintain 50 ohms because the pine networks are the size of a garbage can.
You know, you can see the performance of the signal, and you know what that performance looks like on the antenna tuner itself, SWR and power output. And if it's not the right
pattern, then you know you're not putting out.
Let me say it again. You can run a Pi network backwards to raise, to play games with the pieces. But the reason the backwards move is everybody's so happy we're going down from 5,000 to 50, the Pi network is a very happy camper under those conditions. Under other conditions, not so much. And usually to solve the problem involves using much larger redundancies and capacitances, and the size goes up exponentially. Yep.
If memory serves, when Dick used to discuss impedance of transmitters, he would specifically say that transmitters are not designed to have an inherent impedance of 50 ohms. They're designed to operate within their specifications, outputting to a load of 50 ohms. Now, that's just what I remember him saying on this TechNet more than a dozen times. Other people, especially with electrical engineering degrees, can totally disagree with that. I won't argue the comment, but that was the comment that I distinctly recall that Dick used to mention repeatedly.
Yes, transistors have very, very low output. You have to step it up in the output filter of the reed to 50 ohms. If you do not have that output filter, in addition to having all kinds of spurious emissions getting out, it would be a bear. You'd have a very, very low output impedance.
Yeah, I understand that, but the way that Dick described it. Yes, Howie, please. I understand. You really want to get into this.
The problem you have is the way you got this, the way, I don't mean to be rude, but nobody reinforces. What Dick was saying, he said, look at that thing as a current source. If you look at the transmitter as being a current source, it's a high impedance device. That's what it was. And the reason why you matched it, because that was convenient. It's a high impedance device, okay? All right, I'm going to get out of here. But that's what Dick was talking about. Look at it with nodal analysis, and look at it as a current source. And an ideal current source is a high impedance device. And when you look at a transistor, you're not using a Pi network; you're using a T network because it's running at much lower voltages.
Okay, Howard. I don't know if the subject just kind of evaporated or what. If David or Ed wants to discuss this further, please feel free.
Well, I think about choices, You have loads and loads of choices. If somebody complains that they have too many choices, then give them more choices.
Okay, sometimes people don't like too many choices. It confuses them.
I don't understand the comment about transistors having a network. A transistor can use any network you want, so long as it works. And C networks are probably a good solution, but they're not the only one. It may be that a lot of manufacturers have decided, see this I don't know, a lot of manufacturers have decided that C-network is the best overall solution for them. But it doesn't mean it's the only one. If you can't use it for some other reason, then maybe another one that works. But then, it's got to work. If it doesn't work, it doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah, that's quite true. Maybe it's a monetary factor. Maybe Pi networks are more expensive and don't provide any additional benefit. I don't know.
No, here's the thing. Okay. You can turn a Pi network around and go from a lower impedance to a higher impedance. But when you're dealing with numbers like 1 ohm to 50 ohms, the components become very large.
WDKH, WW, Roy, I can give you the exact reasons for that. To him, as far as the transistor, a transistor. It's not that it puts us a transistor. It's the operating voltage. If I want to run 100 watts, so I've got 200 watts input. Let's say you're only getting a 50% efficiency. You're running class AB. You take that. You take the voltage divided by the current, the E over I, and that's going to give you the voltage. There's a couple of ways you do that. You know, when you're looking at 700-800 volts, and you want to get the same power, you're only using a couple hundred milliamperes. Okay, if you got a tube like a 6146, and you want to put out, let's say, 100 watts. So you run about 130, at 800 volts. So what is it, 800 times, whatever it is, 150 milliamps, 200 milliamps is? Say you run 200 milliamps at 800, that's 160 watts. So look at the impedance. You find out the impedance, and then you have to transfer it. It's easier to go from a high impedance to a low impedance using a PI network. It's easier to go from a low impedance to a high impedance to a 50-ohm impedance, let's say from a half an ohm to 50 ohms, which would be a 100-to-1 transformation using a T network or an L network or some other kind of network. Pi networks are different from going from high to low impedance.
I find that when power reading is 100 watts and SWR is 1.1, and I can see the modulation of the upper sideband audio, that's when I know I'm getting out. And if it's not like that, then, there could be weather, there could be all kinds of things going on.
Well, you're relying on past experience with a given radiating antenna, but you get the same results with a dummy load. You could have a full 100% of your output, 100 watts going out, and you have an SWR of 1.0, and yet your dummy load is not an efficient radiator of RF.
Well, thank you, Roy. I do appreciate that. Yeah, well, I've been doing this for a while. I had some experience, whether it's, super academic or not, I don't know. But it seems to work for me. I had some experience with building radios from tubes from a television, an old TV, and building dipole antennas, which is pretty easy, But I was able to get signal out, and, I guess that in itself was all the fulfillment.
Okay, yeah, ultimately it's making contacts with people is the bottom line. You need a 100% efficient antenna. You don't need an infinite amount of energy. If propagation is working in your favor and everything is clicking, then, you could bend a lot of rules and still have a good conversation back and forth. But, that's ultimately what matters. If the theory says you should be having lots of contacts, but you're not, then there's obviously a problem, even though the theory is fine.
We make great contacts on the TechNet right here on W2VL repeater. This is KG2RY.
Roy, I have to know. You want those
good words? Sure.
The output impedance of a transmitter before any output filtering is very simple. Take the DC voltage that's on the plate or the collector of the tube or transistor as appropriate and divide it by the current going into it at full power. And that is the impedance. It is actually surprisingly simple. And with that, I leave you. Have a pleasant evening. WV380.
Yeah, Ohm's Law. Live by it, die by it. And Ed, thank you for coming tonight. I wish you a happy, healthy New Year and a tolerable Yom Kippur.
Oh, my Yom Kippur will be very easy. You want to know why?
Why?
I am basically fine. But I do have some issues. And let's go this way. And then it's faster.
Okay, you're allowed to skip the fast if your health is an issue. Judaism doesn't require anyone to kill themselves. That's why I didn't say particularly have a good fast, because I didn't know if you were going to or not, but be well. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Yes, my absence is not for lack of interest, less interfering. Oh, it's super enjoyable. WB3AB,
I understand that. 73. Once again,